When it comes to leading different people in your team at various ages, how do you approach it? On the show today, we have Dave Harper, a career coach. He shares some of the questions that he asks people with us today. So if you're a team leader, even a parent, this will be of real interest to you. Dave's purpose is around helping others achieve. He does this through sharing vulnerability and authenticity in his leadership. He is an advocate of experiential learning and all-round good guy, although he does have some really interesting views on where's the gig economy for professionals. It is a thought-provoking podcast with lots of really useful sound bites and takeaways. Hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today, we are delighted to be joined by David Harper. David is an associate of Scaffold Coaching. You might just think there's only Rachel and I, but there's a few of us. There's David Harper and Steve Bedford, and hopefully Steve will be coming on to do a podcast with us later on this year. David is a career coach. He coaches through his business called Harper 360. Dave, welcome to the podcast. Tell everybody how you got into this and where you started.
Yeah, morning, John. Morning, Rachel. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. So how did I end up being a career coach? Well, first of all, I'll talk about the career bit of it. So I had a long career with a major insurance company. And so that was kind of just topside of 30 years. And you kind of go through that career. And I wasn't the kind of person really that took a lot of coaching or looked for a lot of coaching myself. And I tended to be more of an opportunist, just like things came along, or my boss would say, Dave, how do you fancy doing this? Or better still, Dave, I've put your name down for this. You're doing this. Okay. And that's how I tended to, people used to push me into things rather than me pulling. And you kind of end up in a corporate world, you're going up that kind of slippery slope. And I ended up in the last stage of my career, I was CIO. So looking after all the IT. And for one of Aviva's subdivisions, which was actually a £4 billion business. So you think about it, a £4 billion business. So that could be kind of a decent sized company on the stock market. I was looking after all the IT. And, you know, you wake up some mornings, you realize you're looking after so much money. You know, it was a £35 million budget just to keep the lights on with that business, just to keep all the IT systems running. Was 35 million quid, and I was somehow responsible for that. And that's a really scary thought. I think if I'd have thought about it too much, I probably wouldn't have got out of bed in the morning at all. And then on top of that, you've got about 25 million of change that you're doing every year. People, you know, change is constant, as we know. And people just, you know, wanting new systems built, wanting changes to their existing systems, wanting things outsourced, wanting things insourced. So really kind of complex stuff. So you kind of think, well, okay, so that was the best job, the biggest job I'd ever had. So why did I give all that up? Why did I give that salary up to do this? And there was a couple of reasons really, and I'll come on to the main one in a minute. But one of the things I did realize when I looked at my diary every week, I was often, you know, based in York, but I was often down in London or out in the sites. I had people across five different sites, and I used to look at my diary. And the things that used to really set my diary alight and really inspire me was the odd hour here and there where I was coaching people and I was actually helping them to achieve things. So helping others achieve. And that used to really brighten up my day. I used to really look forward to that slot at 3 o'clock when I'd actually got out of the executive management meeting, sat in the boardroom, and I could actually have a proper conversation with an individual that actually wanted something from me. And actually, you know, wanted me to help them in their career. And the second overriding thing was at 52, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And, you know, I'm not the first bloke to be diagnosed with it. I'm not the first person to be diagnosed with cancer. And I won't be the last one. So I don't want this to be a woe is me. But anybody that's been in that position or had a major kind of event like that, a life-changing event, will know there's nothing like a diagnosis like that to give you a real kick up the backside. to really say what is important in life. So there I was. I was spending the least of my time at work doing the thing that I most enjoyed, and most of my time doing the thing that I enjoyed the least, which was sitting in management meetings and doing the corporate stuff. So having had that diagnosis, having got my head around the actual mechanics of it and the treatment and stuff, it was like when I went back to work, and you know, the company I worked for was absolutely fantastic, and you know, I can't speak highly enough of them. But when I got back to work, you think, right, okay, what needs to change? If you want to do more coaching, you know, what's the list? What needs to be true in order to do this? And I'd always wanted to run my own company. So you make that list, and actually you realize it's not as long as you think it was. It's not as long. So you work through the list, you say, right, tick, tick, tick. And there I was at 55. I'd left corporate life and I was setting up Harper 360. And suddenly I was embarking on this world where I could do what I wanted to do and do what I enjoyed, which was helping others achieve. So, John, that really kind of got me to where I am today.
Well,
5 years ago from where I am today.
It's a very inspiring journey, Dave. I wonder, where did the sort of momentum come from for wanting to achieve at this level when you just left CIO? Where did that come from?
I think there was a gap. I could feel that there was a gap. You know, I'd done over 30 years in my career, but there was still, and it was all that. I was a project manager by trade, and one of the big things we used to talk about was right to left planning, which is, you know, if I just kind of explain it briefly for the non-project managers on the call, is you kind of left to right is your normal stuff. It's like, well, if you've got a project to do, what are we going to do this week? What are we going to do next week? How long is it going to take? What we're going to be doing in a month's time? And the further out you go, the more fuzzy it becomes. That's just natural. Right to left planning, you go right to the end of the schedule, at the end of the project, and you start looking back and say, right, what's it going to be like in 2 years' time when we finish this project? What needs to be in place? And when we look back, what should we have done? What should we be doing now that will make us in that position in 2 years' time? And you just work back, literally right to left. And what made me think, John, was I kind of applied that to my career and to my life, really. I thought, when I'm, you know, let's pick a point in the future. Maybe I'm sort of, you know, we all think we're going to live forever, but nobody's ever managed it yet. But, you know, we still set out in life and we're all doing that kind of left to right planning. We're saying, what am I going to do next week? What am I going to do in a month's time? What am I going to do in a year's time? And you find your career's just ticking away because you're just doing. I was just getting up and I was just doing the same thing because it was a habit, because I'd done it last week and I'd done it the week before. Therefore, I was going to do it this week and I was going to do it next week. But that right to left is, well, you know, however you want to draw that picture, you know, sat in your rocking chair on your veranda, whatever it looks like to you, you sat there and you're looking back on your career, you're looking back on your life. What are all the things you wish you'd done? And it made me realize I wanted to run my own business. I always wanted to be in charge, you know, just setting my own agenda, doing what I wanted to do. And here I had this great opportunity. You know, I got great feedback from the people that I used to coach and the people that I used to mentor. So I thought, well, put those two things together and why not? I don't want to be sat in my rocking chair thinking, I wish I'd have been a coach. I wish I'd have had my own business.
Yeah.
There's too many if only conversations. Mm. If only I'd done this, if only I'd done that. And there's only one person to fix it. And I was looking at him in the mirror every morning. So that's what I did. That's how I got into it.
Oh, Dave, there's so many things that you're saying there that I think will be ringing alarm bells with people as they're listening to this, or alarm bells, or, oh, I felt like that. There's a few things I just wanted to pick up on what you said. And it sounds to me like you became a CIO, a chief information officer, by accident, you know, like the accidental career progression. And we see this a lot. And you said the slippery slope, you know, just progression after progression, and it's not really you taking control of your career, is it? And I'm just wondering, you know, you had that kick up the arse with the cancer diagnosis that got you to reevaluate your life and where you were at, and you mentioned you'd been coaching and mentoring people before, and you know, both a blessing and a curse, obviously, that diagnosis, in that it's helped you change your life, but horrendous way to get to that point. But what did that journey look like from going, I'm going to set up my own business and I'm going to start coaching people? Had you had any formal coaching training? Is it more the mentoring you focus on, or things that you've observed across your career? I just find it really interesting and very curious about how you've landed more in really focusing on young people. And did that require any special training, or did anybody help you navigate that path, really? Because it wasn't overnight that you just handed your notice in, is it? And then you know, it's a scary thing starting up a business that, again, takes a little bit of time.
Yeah, it is a scary thing. And there's no getting away from the fact that, you know, I was towards the end of my career, and I had that kind of financial security that not everybody has. So in terms of, you know, when you're starting a business, you know, as you know, Rachel, you take huge risk financially, because will it work? Will it pay the bills? You know, will it support the mortgage and all the rest of it? And, you know, if I'm really honest, at that stage of my career, just turned 50, I didn't have a lot of those pressures. My children were growing up, they'd been through university, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it felt like everything was becoming aligned, and it was a it's now or never type thing.
Yeah.
The thing that gave me the final push was that I was that within the company I work for, they were doing a leadership program, and what they wanted to do, it was all about authenticity and vulnerability. They were, you know, playing big on that. And what they asked was quite a few of the senior leaders to actually go through the course, and then to train as kind of, you know, to lead the actual sessions, to do the delivery of the course, rather than it being something that HR just delivered to us. They wanted authentic leaders and who could display vulnerability to actually be on that course. And when I went on the train the trainer, boy, were people being vulnerable. You know, people talking about stuff you've never talked to people at work about at that stage. And this was only kind of just over 5 years ago. You know, I remember they asked us all to do our little story, and I did a really safe story about kind of when I took over this team and how I was trying to be authentic with the team. The next person to go up was a senior lady within the business, who said about when she came out, when she told everybody that she was gay at work, and how that felt. And I thought, wow, I've never heard people talking like this at work. And it's almost, it kind of gives you permission to do that stuff. And by the time I was delivering the course, I was then talking about how I felt to have been diagnosed with cancer, and talking about how I felt as a leader, and how vulnerable I felt because I couldn't actually get out and visit people at the site. You know, when I went back to work after I'd done my cancer treatment and stuff, we'd had a merger inevitably, and then I was in charge of systems and processes and people and teams across five different sites. But my doctor had said, well, there's no way you're going to be traveling up and down the country. You know, you need to leave that a couple of months until you bed back in. So there I was. I was, you know, these teams who now somebody told them, oh, David Harper, he's your new CIO, you know, come and meet him. Well, I could have come and meet them. You know, I couldn't actually travel. And as the weeks built up, I just felt really almost guilty and embarrassed as a leader that I couldn't meet them face to face. And everybody was great. You know, they explained, well, you know, Dave's coming back, he's rehabilitated back into the business, you know, he needs to take it steady, and you'll see him eventually, but you know, he can't travel to Bristol or Norwich or London at the moment. And I ended up one Friday afternoon, and I felt so guilty. It was just building up. It was like a balloon that was about to go pop. And I wrote this really honest, open email to everybody and just said, look, you know, I'm really sorry I can't visit. You know, this is why, and this is how I feel, but I will, you know, get on that train eventually, but please bear with me. And what really shocked me there, two things really. As soon as I'd sent that, I felt like this balloon had kind of, you know, gone pop, and I'd released all this pressure that was building up inside of me. And it was all in my head. You know, that was the thing. Nobody was telling me, Dave, you need to go to Bristol. Dave, everybody's asking who you are and why you're not visible as a leader. And so it kind of released all this pressure. But the replies I got from it, people were telling me about their own cancer stories. They were telling me really kind of personal stuff about kind of when the mum was diagnosed with cancer, or the father was currently having treatment for cancer, and it was really bothering them. It was really affecting them at work, and they were pleased that somebody had raised it and that they could actually talk to me about it. And I thought, oh my God, this vulnerability thing. You know, now I've woken up and realized that actually leaders can be vulnerable. Actually, once you are human and vulnerable as a leader, look what happens. Loads of people say, oh yeah, I've had that. Oh yeah, that happened to me. Oh wow. And you start having a different conversation with people. You move away from the kind of transactional stuff of, is this system working? Is it going to be ready by 8 o'clock on Monday morning? Have we told all the users that, you know, how to sign on to the system, all that usual transactional stuff. You're into kind of real deep conversations with people, the real humanity of going to work. And actually, you know, the great thing about it is it helps you do the other stuff better, because people understand that you're human and you see the human side of everybody else.
Yeah, I think thanks so much for sharing that, Dave. I think just to comment on why we love working with you so much is like, that was 5 years ago. You know, vulnerability's talked, a lot of people experienced that in COVID, but this is 5 years ago, feels like a different time for you to have been leading in that space. So yeah, thank you for sharing that.
I think, Dave, it's a really sort of essential leadership trait, isn't it? Being able to be vulnerable, this idea that leaders go first and you role model, being very much you, which I think is also quite an essential sort of quality, if you like, to be a good coach, an effective coach. Talk to us a little bit more about what you're at now then with your career coaching. And is there a bridge between what you've just talked about and why that has become like the specialism that you're interested in and that you enjoy working with people, in your words, helping others achieve?
Yeah, I think if I kind of look back on the 5 years and kind of bring that right up to date, I think I've done a whole series of things. You know, I've done the IT consultancy thing, which is great, you know, helping smaller companies kind of achieve. So you're almost like doing a coaching for the CIO there, just to kind of they described it as really a steady in hand. You know, they know what they need to do, but they just need somebody who's been there and done it, who's got a bit more experience with a larger corporate, just to help them. So that IT consulting thing, you know, and it pays really well, so it's great work if you can get that kind of work. But then when I think about the coaching that I've done and the voluntary work that I've got into more recently, I've tended, really without necessarily setting myself up to market myself as this, I've ended up with that kind of, I suppose if you had to put a label on it, an age bracket label, it's really the 18-year-olds to about the sort of early 30s. And you know, that I've got a lot of that through recommendation, but I've absolutely loved working with that group of people, because it's so rich, and there's so much energy in that group of people that they're starting off on their careers. And often you get kind of people who maybe come out of university or college, don't really know what to do next, don't know what the world of work is like. And you kind of sit with them and, you know, and I've helped some of those people by just using the networks that I've got, just to get them, you know, just to get them a day, just to go along and sit at a company, just to go along to, you know, as a company in Leeds where I got a lad, he was doing maths and he was really into his maths, but he didn't want to be an actuary like his father, because, you know, he just saw that as boring. His dad wanted him to be an actuary, but he didn't want to. And I said, well, there's other stuff you can do with your maths, you know, there's all sorts of stuff. And what he's ended up in is, it sounds a bit trivial, but it's not. It's the betting and gaming industry. So he's ended up with one of the big, he's ended up at Sky Bet in Leeds. And, you know, they use all sorts of mathematical algorithms and analysis. And they, you know, they love getting maths graduates into their business. And then it's just a different application of the same thing that actuaries do, but on a, you know, a lot, it's a very short time scale for the betting, very long time scale for the actuarial work. But I remember when I talked to him and he was, I said, I've got you this day at Sky Bet. You know, what do you think? He said, oh, it'd be great. Yeah, it'd be great. I said, well, have a think about these. So I gave him three questions to think about. One of the questions was, what's the most amazing thing that could happen in that day at Sky Bet? And so we sat down a couple of days before he went. I said, have you thought about these questions? He said, yeah. I said, well, what about this one? Tell me, what is the most amazing thing that will happen on that day for you? You know, how could it go the best it could ever go? And he said, well, he said, I'm going to go along. I'm going to learn loads of stuff. He said, I'm really interested in maths. I'm really interested in how they set the odds for things. I'm really interested in kind of whether they make money or not. Yeah, great. All right, that's your most amazing thing that'll happen. Yeah. I said, well, how about this? I said, what if you just went along that day and they were so impressed with you? At the end of the day, they said, oh my God, who's that guy? We're going to have to get him back for a recruitment day because, you know, we need to employ him in the business before one of our competitors does. And they offer you a job there and then. He said, oh, that'd be amazing. I said, well, why didn't you say that? And it's just, we know as coaches, don't we? It's that old friend of ours, that old enemy, self-limiting beliefs.
Yeah, yeah.
And even with somebody kind of aged, you know, 20, 21, going into that position, they've already set their self-limiting beliefs. There's no, you know, in their head, there's no way I'm going to get offered a job. So I'll just go along and enjoy it. I'll learn a load of stuff. Yeah. It'll be a bit of a skive, you know, and there you are. So what did he do? He went along. He made such an impression. They invited him back to the recruitment day the week after. He went through the selection and he's now been working at Sky Bet for 3 years.
Wonderful.
And that warms your heart. It really does. And, you know, he's never looked back from that point. There was no, I love that group because they're so raw. There's no cynicism. There's no kind of negativity. It's all opportunity, but there's a lot of naivety. There's a lot of, I don't really know what this is like. Can you help me just get my head around the world of work? So
elaborate for us, because we there'll be a few people listening to this that have got younger people on their team and they might be like mid managers or, you know, millennial level, late 30s, early 40s, 50 year old team leaders and people managers that are like, I've got graduates on my team. I've got younger people on my team that have maybe only been in the role a couple of years. And they're in that crux of like, where you've learned by delegating, you know, you've just showed them what to do as a leader. And then you're having to switch to like, how can I introduce some coaching stuff to get them to think for themselves? Just like that Sky Bet example that you showed, like he wasn't capable of thinking, I could get a job from this day until, you know, a wise guide like yourself kind of opens up that and explores that opportunity with him. And so there'll be a few people listening to this thinking, you know, where does coaching fit and at what age? And how do I approach it when I'm time short, when I'm sick of telling people what to do, when I need them to step up? You know, you specialise in this area of working with, you know, you are in your late 50s and you coincidentally have totally chosen to specialise with Gen Z, you know, that 18 to late 20s cohort. How do you approach it? And you know, talk us through how you work with Mind, how you work with the universities, how do you do it?
I think I'm a massive believer in experiential learning. And even that example at Sky Bet was just dropping somebody into that company for a day and say, let's see how it goes. And then you do the conversation before, the preparation stuff. You do the conversation after, you know, what have you learned? What was good? What was not good? What would you do differently next time? That whole kind of cycle of experiential learning. And when I look back on my own career, that's a lot of how I developed as an individual, because as I say, I wasn't pulling things, people were pushing me into things. But you know, my bosses, I remember they dropped me into situations that I was absolutely terrified in. You know, when I got my first team, I was absolutely terrified being a team leader, but I could do it because I've proved since that I could do it, and they saw something in me that I couldn't see in myself. So I would say a really good starting point for that generation is just to just to put them in situations that will probably scare them quite a bit, but to support them through it. You know, send them to that meeting where, you know, they're going to be working with people who aren't necessarily in their peer group, who've got a lot more understanding than they have. But, you know, don't just drop them in it. Just have a word with them and listen to them before they go in about what their, you know, what their reservations are, how they're going to approach it, what their fears are. Give them a few pointers about. I mean, I worked with a lady in the NHS, and she graduated. She probably got about 2 or 3 years under belt on their graduate scheme, and a boss said to her, "I want you to come to this meeting with me." And so it was like, I don't know how NHS meetings work, but I can imagine from what she said how they work, that people sit round and they're looking at statistics and they're all kind of trying to monitor service levels and all this. It's very kind of business-like, I guess, a long way removed from the, you know, the clinical delivery that you get in A&E. But she went along to this meeting with her boss, and I said, "How did it go?" She said, "Well, yeah, it was all right." So it was a bit boring, really. She said they were just looking at stats and talking about kind of service level. Right, okay. And I said, "Well, what coaching did your boss give you?" She said, "Well, he took me along and said, I want you to experience this and, you know, make sure you say something." Okay. I said, "What did you say?" She said, "I didn't say anything." I said, "Well, how long was the meeting?" 3 hours. "You didn't say anything." Right. Okay. I said, "Well, what do you think about that?" "Well, I just, the longer the meeting went on, I just, you know," I said, "Why didn't you say anything? If your boss wanted you to say something." She said, "Well, I didn't, it wasn't my place. I didn't know what to say because they were just speaking a different language." And we kind of unpacked that, and I just wish she'd had more proper coaching before she went in, rather than, you know, just make sure you say something. "Oh, that's great. That's like your mother used to, you know, my mother used to say to me, you know, when you were worried about something, come on, pull yourself together, snap out of it." "Oh, that's great coaching, that is, you know," but it's what people used to say. It's kind of an old fashioned way of doing it. But what we unpacked was, I said, "Well, you know, there is a way of making sure that you do speak in a meeting." I said, "Because you do it early on, you know, say something early on, and then you feel so much better, because you're not, as the meeting goes on, you've got this little devil on your shoulder saying, you haven't spoken yet, have you? Dave, you haven't spoken yet. Rachel, your boss said you had to speak, but you haven't said anything, have you?" The longer it goes on, the harder it gets to actually say those first words. So make sure you speak within the first 5 minutes of the meeting. Whatever it is, just speak, and you'll feel so much more confident, and so on.
Do you
and
think
she was worried about you? Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, do you think it's harder now for people in this Gen Z, as we're talking about that group, that sort of 18 to sort of late 20s, is it harder for them? And therefore, should they be looking for somebody like yourself as a coach in order to support them and be able to promote ideas like the ones you've talked about? Or because we're looking at it from an older generational point of view, and we've had the experience and we've been put in those situations. I'm just thinking, with the way that the world is it just harder now?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, John, that generation communicate in different ways. There's less talking face-to-face, there's more texting, there's more social media, there's more messaging. And, you know, in terms of practice, you know, have they had enough practice actually looking people in the eye in kind of meetings and delivering something confidently to people's, you know, face-to-face? Have they had enough practice in that? And I would say not, from the clients that I work with. Can they do it? Yeah, of course they can, because, you know, inside we're human beings, and human beings can communicate with each other. That's what we've been doing for, you know, thousands of years. So it's kind of within their gift. But they worry about sort of things that, as you say, John, our generation wouldn't necessarily worry about. Things like the lady I was talking about, she was worried about a Yorkshire accent. And she said, "As soon as I speak, everybody will be thinking, oh, she's right Yorkshire." Well, or they'll be thinking, "She's right Yorkshire." And so she had this kind of a limiting belief that as soon as you open your mouth, you'd be judged based on your accent. And I think that is true, because human beings do judge other people, whether they set out to judge them or not. That's what we do. That's what makes us human. You know, first impressions are first impressions, and we all do that. It's a great trait to have as human beings, to be able to assess the world around you. But, you know, does it become a self-limiting belief? Well, it can do. And so what I did was I thought, well, we need to help her just kind of crack this. So, you know, I've worked with lots of very firm-minded, strong Yorkshire female role models in my time who I'd seen come into meetings and really, you know, really carry it off authoritatively, you know, a room full of men. And that was the only female in the room, and would absolutely boss it because they knew their subject and they were speaking with a Yorkshire accent. And as they got more into their subject, their accent got broader because they got more passionate and so on, and let go of the business speak. So I got hold of a few videos of these people, and they're all in senior positions now in different organizations. And I just said, just watch these. I said, just watch these as role models. I said, there they are, the top of their game, with strong Yorkshire accents. I said, and then ask yourself, is it really a limiting factor? And I said, and they often turn around and say, you know, and you ask the question, where is it a limiting factor? And the answer is always the same, in my head.
Yeah.
And once that penny drops with that generation, suddenly they give themselves permission to talk. Because I think that's what's consistently holding them back, just giving themselves permission to do that stuff.
It's being able to ask those really incisive questions, isn't it? And open people's minds up to possibilities.
Yeah, I think so. And John, you, when we worked together at the start, you know, many years ago, I always remember a phrase you used, which was particularly as a coach, is to ask better questions, think of better questions. And I use that a lot with people. So, you know, when she was going into that meeting, think about the questions you would ask. Think about, you know, you don't need to sit there and pronounce some sort of statement that is either right or wrong. Just throw questions in. Things like, so how are we going to do that? So how will we know if that's worked? And is that something new we've done, or have we ever done it before? Have we got any experience of doing this? And I said, they're all great business questions, and nobody could deny that you've got a right to ask that question, and you will get a response, and you'll start a discussion. I said, but what it does, it gives you space, it gives you thinking time. And if somebody puts you on the spot and say, what do you think about this? Just ask them a question back. So when you say this, what do you mean? Do you mean the whole thing, or do you mean, you know, just the thing we've been talking about today? And by asking better questions, you just create that space for a bit more time, a bit more thought. You're getting rid of that monkey off your back because you're talking, you're conversing in the meeting and relaxing into it. So I think, Rachel, the question you've asked in terms of helping this group of people, it's often just very small things, you know, just giving them little tips of things to try. And it's not about, you know, what works for me won't necessarily work for you. But that's not what it's about. It's about almost having a kit bag of things you can try and what works for you. And then you'll find something that works for you, and then you just repeat it. And that becomes your signature style then.
How do you, Dave, oscillate in sessions with younger people that you will say coaching? Because it sounds to me like you're half coaching, half mentoring. Like, you're asking a lot of great questions, but you're also giving them things to think about, which isn't coaching, it is mentoring. And certainly setting somebody up to go and work in Sky Bet for the day is mentoring, not coaching. But it sounds to me like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you do give them a lot of space. So do you kind of structure it in your head where you're like, you'll start with the coaching, then you'll flip to the mentoring when you see that they're struggling with things? Because how would you know how to get that monkey or chimp off your back when you're that young and you haven't got that experience? You need a bit of mentoring on that, don't you? You need a bit of new knowledge. But I guess what I'm asking is, do you always try and start with the coaching? Does it start with a mentoring relationship and you progress them up to coaching? Or do you just change it on an individual level? And how does your mindset change so you're conscious of going, I am telling somebody what I think here versus I'm asking questions and I'm purely coaching? Where do you sit in how you're structuring that?
Yeah, great question. I think it absolutely starts with the listening every time. Listening wins over everything.
Yeah.
So you start with the listening and just find out, you know, where is this person at? What are they looking for? What are they searching for? And often you get, short statements about, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. But as we know, you've got to dig into that and say why that, you know, and you've got to, as we said, ask the better questions. And sometimes, you know, it's just a mask and you dig deeper and actually there's other things going on. So it's really important. And, you know, I find this a lot of the work I do with York Mind on the Young Person Program, helping them with their mental health. And this is young people anywhere from age 11 up to age 18 or 20. So it's a different kind of set of people, but I think the challenges are very similar. And the first couple of sessions you have with a young person, you just sit there listening and you've just got to press a button and sit back. And what I found in transitioning from being a project manager and a CIO to being a coach is that I've had to really, really work on my listening, because the nature of project management, you're often barking out instructions, you're often giving instructions and telling people what to do. Yes, you've got to, as a leader, you've got to create the right environment for people to be successful. But you're actually saying, right, we need this, you know, we need to do this by next Friday. Or when are you going to finish this? Or have we got this lined up? Have we managed that dependency? How is it going with that supplier? Very kind of transactional stuff. And in that context, it's hard for me to sit back. If I think I know the answer, to sit back and just listen, because I'm just dying to say, why don't you do this? Why? It's obvious to me. Why don't you do this? But that's the great thing about coaching, because I feel like I've developed so much in the last 5 years, because I've gone from that transactional person barking those instructions out to somebody who can physically sit back and listen. And we know listening is actually hard, because, you know, in those NHS meetings or whatever, you can guarantee that everybody is waiting to speak, that everybody sits there waiting for the next opportunity to speak, because that's a human thing. But just sit back and just listen. And when the young people, particularly, after about the second or third session, you say to them, well, how's that going? And they say, it's going really well. I say, well, what's good about it? They say, well, you actually listen to me. All right, okay. I said, what do you mean by that? I said, you know, that's my job. I come along and listen. That's what I do. And they say, you don't interrupt me. And you don't give me solutions. You don't kind of tell me what to do. And I said, well, you know, is that so right? Yeah, you're the only person that's listened to me when I've talked about this. All the other times, my mum and dad have interrupted me and just told me what to do and given me advice. So they're not really listening. They just want to get on with the next thing and sort me out. I don't want sorted out. I just want listening to. And I think, oh, my God, was listening ever in such short supply? And then I think about that kind of generation, that Gen Z, of kind of their texting. And, you know, when you hear them talking at the bus stop or wherever, they're all talking over each other. They're talking so fast because they need to get all their words out and then move on to the next thing. And they're sending messages. And if they don't get a reply straight away, it means that somebody's dissed them or whatever the word is for that these days. But somebody's, you know, they're not replying. You know, it's just that ability to actually listen, just stop and listen to each other. And you say to them, well, what about your friends at school? Do you talk to them about what you've just told me? Well, I do, but then they don't listen either. They're talking, you know, they talk over me or interrupt me.
Yeah. And oh my goodness.
It kind of makes me.
There's so much gold in that. Let's just unpack it a bit. Number one, I would like you to elaborate a bit more on what you do for York Mind, because the fact that you're having coaching conversations with, you know, kids as young as 11 is remarkable. And I think there's a real, let's dig into that, because it was very heartwarming what you just said then about, you know, it is such a gift to be able to listen to somebody. And if that's the first time these people have ever been heard, that's a wonderful gift to give. But on that thing about children and their teens and their mates not listening to them. I mean, you only have to walk past a school at lunchtime, don't you, and hear the noise to know that there ain't no listening going on whatsoever in a school playground. There's a lot of noise. But on that, and there will be a lot of parents listening to this. And actually, we talk about Gen Z, but I'm millennial, and that hasn't changed much from when I was a kid. Do you know what I mean? Like being in your teenage years and not ever really feeling like any adult ever really listened to you. They told you what to do a lot of the time. But talk us through what goes on in, you know, how you came into that your mind coaching, and how does somebody a year, you know, 11 years, 12 years, 13 years of age, kind of what are you coaching them on, or without breaking any confidences, and what tips have you got for any kind of parents of teenagers listening to this thinking I'm at my wit's end, I don't know how to communicate with a teenager today?
Yeah, I mean, the program that I do is young person's mentoring, so it's very much badged as a mentoring thing. That's right. So the whole setup is really about You've got young people who are struggling with their mental health. They've either referred themselves, or more often it's either their teacher or their parents that have referred them. And they go through a kind of initial selection. So the ones that end up on the mentoring program that I'm working with are very much at the the lesser end of the spectrum of issues, if you can call it that, if I can generalize so much in that statement.
Yeah, because you're not a psychologist and you're not a counselor, are you?
So, yeah. Yeah, and it's absolutely not counseling. It is absolutely kind of that mentoring, and you know, somebody older that's not got a relationship with them. You're not their teacher, you're not their parent, you're not their counselor. You're just a guy that just comes in and listens. And I try and keep it really, really kind of really informal and really kind of non-threatening with them. And just, you know, I often do say to them, you know, when we set in the ground rules at the start, I said, you know, I'm a volunteer. I come in here and do this because I enjoy doing it. I'm here to listen. That's what I do. I come along. You can talk about anything you want in this room, and I'm not going to report back to anybody. So I've got a supervisor that helps me, you know, at York Mine, but they're part of the system. But I said, I'm not, anything you tell me, you won't get back to your parents, won't get back to your teachers. It's just between us. You can talk about whatever you want. And unless you've committed an offence, I won't be telling anybody else. And once they relax into that, then you realise you're it's such a privileged position, because they actually say, I haven't told my mum and dad that, but I'm telling you. Okay. And you think, wow, you know, they haven't told anybody else, but somehow they trust you to tell you. And a lot of it is the same dynamic as a coaching relationship, because you know, it's that know, like, trust, that Mark Twain thing. You know, do I know Dave? Well, yeah, he's my mentor at York Mind. Do I trust him? Well, I don't know. I haven't worked with him long enough to do I like him? Well, yeah, he seemed all right. Do I trust him? And it's usually three or four sessions before they actually, you really get that trust. So whether you're working with a person, you know, a young person who's 11, or whether you're coaching somebody in their 30s, 40s, 50s, it's still that same dynamic about building that trust in the first few sessions. But yeah, through that listening, you just keep asking them questions. Well, why do you think that happened? And they come along and, you know, they've been through, you know, it really is heart-rending. If you got too emotionally involved in this, you'd be in tears yourself, you know, because some of the things you think, you're only 11 and all this stuff's happened to you. And often it's about kind of relationship breakup, marriage breakup of their parents, that they're carrying this guilt around with them. And, you know, they're now having to live between two homes, you know, 50% in one, 50% in the other. And that's not uncommon. That's really common. But in their head, it's like something they've done wrong. And I'm convinced that by giving them a safe space to talk about that stuff with somebody who's completely independent and won't tell anybody, it's just like a massive release for them, just somebody to listen to all that stuff. And once they've talked about it, first of all, they feel so much better talking about it. And you can try and put things into context about, well, you know, no wonder you feel anxious about different situations, because you've lived through some really stressful situations that, frankly, somebody at the age of 14 shouldn't have been expected, wouldn't be emotionally mature enough to deal with. So no wonder you're feeling insecure about stuff. And just somebody saying that to them just kind of almost like normalizes it and says, oh, okay, right, I kind of get this. I can put it in a box. I can deal with it a bit better. I know why I'm feeling like this. I've got a reason for it because of all these things I've been through, which actually aren't my fault. They've just kind of happened to me. They've been circumstantial. And, you can kind of draw out the positives with them as well about, you know, what have you learned? Well, actually, because of these experiences, you've had so much more life experience than somebody would normally have in your, you know, what are the positives? What have you, where have you developed resilience that's going to help you in later life, rather than somebody who's had, you know, somebody like me who had a, you know, almost a perfect upbringing, really loving family, and you arrive at a point, but you're almost like in your early 20s, you're naive because none of this stuff's happened to you. You know, when I went through a divorce in my early 40s, I would, you know, I'd had a lot of people at work that I've worked with who'd gone through divorces, and I used to sit there going, yeah, it's terrible, isn't it? Yeah. And in the back of my head, I was thinking, well, they must have done something wrong. There must be something wrong with them if they couldn't, you know, the relationship went wrong. But, you know, I'll help them as much as I can, but I can't really empathize with them because it must be their fault. When you've been through it yourself, you think, crikey, it's, you know, it's not like that at all. So subsequently, when I've been through it and people used to come to me and say, Dave, I don't know how to tell you this. Well, okay, just tell it me how, you know, just tell me what's happening. Just, you know, however you want. Well, I'm kind of, you know, my work's struggling. Well, why is your work? Because we've got problems at home. Okay. And you kind of know how to deal with it because you've been through it yourself. And suddenly I used to look very differently on those kind of situations because I'd had that life experience. And I think these young people who've been through these experiences, although they can only see the negative and it manifests itself in anxiety, actually they're getting loads of life experience that in future years they will know that they've got resilience through this. But boy, they shouldn't have needed to, but that's kind of life, isn't it?
They just need to be able to recognise that, how to decouple that anxiety from that, because otherwise people carry this anxiety and it manifests a lot of problems in your 20s. So that is really heartwarming to hear that's been offered to people.
I think it goes to sort of underline, doesn't it, the idea that people really need time to be listened to. I couldn't help drawing the comparison between the person you were talking about that you were coaching, mentoring at York Mind under this program, Dave, and the email that you needed to send to all the people that you were feeling guilty about when you were working and not being able to go and see. And you felt that once you'd sent that, that balloon sort of collapsed down and you didn't feel so much pressure. People need to get it actually off their chest, but they need to be able to do it in an environment that they know to be safe.
Yeah,
I'm sort of wondering, how does this transcend then to the other end of the age group? I know you've got some thoughts on what's happening now with people that might be in their early 50s, maybe, who have probably got to a position like you did, where maybe they're quite financially secure, maybe they're not, but they've got a lot to give back to the actual, to the world and to the world of work. How do you approach those people, and what are your thoughts around coaching at that end of the spectrum?
Yeah, I think you're spot on, John. That kind of group have got so much to give. And I don't think at the moment the kind of ecosystem that we're in is making it easy for that group of people to actually... almost, if you think of it in worthy terms, you know, give back to society. You know, so when I finished corporate life at 55, I could have put my feet up. You know, I could have been having a nice rest for the last 5 or 6 years, but I didn't want to do that. And I think a lot of people are in that position. You know, they maybe get to that level of financial security that I talked about, and they want to do something, but it's not easier. You know, it's There's a lot of stuff in the press at the moment about the it was billed a great retirement initially, and it's all driven by the fact that the if you kind of follow the thread through the press, it's driven by the fact that the labour market is what they call a very tight market, that there's not enough people available to do the work, so there's a lot of vacancies and stuff, and people say, well, where have all these people gone? You know, it wasn't like this before the pandemic. Well, there's, you know, there's stuff like Brexit, which, you know, whatever your view is, it's probably contributed to it, the tight labour market. But the other thing they go after is, well, what about the over 50s? You know, what are they doing? Get them all back to work. You know, what the hell are they doing? You know, putting their feet up and all this. So it was first of all, the great resignation. Then it became the great retirement. And I read a headline the other day in one of the Sunday Nationals that called it the big lie down. I mean, how bloody patronizing is that, you know, for somebody like me who's just turned 60? It's like, oh my God, you know, you think that all those over 50s have finished work because they've had that realization in the pandemic that there is more to life than work, and actually they don't need to, you know, they don't need to go in every day and do what they've done as a kind of habit, as I was doing. They can have a different life. So what do they want to do? Well, they certainly don't want to go and lie down. They want to do some other stuff. So they might be out skiing, they might be out walking, they might be out driving, doing all this other stuff. But if you want to get them back to work, you've got to give a different proposition to, well, you know, you can come and work part-time, or you can we'll be flexible, you can work from home. Because in my view, and it is only my view, the they're tired old solutions. You know, I think about my own situation and how difficult it's been to engage with companies on an outcome basis. So, you know, what I would say as an IT professional, as a coach, as a mentor, is, well, tell me what you want the outcome to be. I'll give you a price for it. And then if you want me to do it, I'll come and do it. Offer me a job 3 days a week and I don't want to do it, because I don't want to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, because I might be doing something on Tuesday next week. And actually, I don't want to prioritize that above what I want to do. So it's a kind of mindset thing, really. And I'd like to see more of companies being braver and offering a different type of proposition. So if you're a legal professional or an accountant, you know, companies must have legal work to do where they could have a list of people who are qualified to do that work, who've already been vetted, and say, right, OK, we've got a lot of legal work on at the moment, so we'll just dish out a few outcomes to people. And then say, right, by next Friday, I need you to have done this to this standard, reviewed this contract, or put this contract together, and you'll do it, and I'll pay you this much for doing it. Great. But there's, you know, you don't really get, that's not commonplace, because that group isn't trusted to deliver those outcomes. It's easier for that group to deliver a pizza than it is to deliver a professional business outcome. You could go to Deliveroo and say, right, you know, I'll sign up. And the delivery drivers, they just sit there, and they get jobs coming up on their firm, and they just choose which jobs they want. Then they go do the jobs, then they get paid for it. That's the gig economy. Well, where's the gig economy for professionals? You know, we're just patronizing them, saying it's the big lie down, and scratching our heads and wondering why, you know, they don't want a part-time job. And, you know, we're letting them work from home. We're being really generous to that group. Well, hello, it's not what they're looking for. Speak to your customers and find out what they actually want, and what will bring them back into the world of work.
What do you think this obsession with time is? Because you explained it brilliantly then. It's like, if you said, oh, you want this outcome and I'll price for it, makes people very nervous. But paying you £600 a day for 3 days a week, yeah, we'll do that. You're like, but what's the difference? Like, what? And I don't think that's unique necessarily to just the over 50s. It's just obviously it's compounded at that end of the market.
Yeah.
So much untapped resource and expertise. Mm. What's your stab at, I mean, there's obviously a lot of factors, but what do you think it is, this obsession we've got with pricing time?
I think it's a financial obsession. I think it's because you can measure. You know, you can measure a contract to say, right, you know, you come in 3 days a week, I pay you £600 a day, therefore I'm paying you £1,800 a week. We'll gross that up. We'll know how much tax you're going to pay. We'll know how much national insurance we're going to pay. We'll look at all of our workforce. We'll know how much the workforce covers. So if you're a public limited company, you kind of, when you do your results to the city, you'll be able to tell them how big your costs are, your salary bill, and it all gets, you know. So the accountants, I think, that sit at the top of that are very comfortable that they've got the all the measures. They know how much the workforce costs. If you had it more random, which is, as we know, Rachel, you know, companies, it's a different kind of accounting treatment if they're buying in consultancy, because it's an external spend. It's a variable spend. And generally, companies I've found are less willing to spend money externally, even if it's more beneficial. It's kind of, they'll have a workforce of a certain size and they know where they stand. You know, all this variable stuff of giving different people different contracts, I think, is more difficult to track and it's more difficult to measure. But as you say, you know, why have somebody sat there, you know, not fully occupied for 3 days a week and still picking up their 3 days of money every week, when you could have somebody who you said, you know, who's taken the risk and said, I'll deliver this outcome for this amount of money. And, you know, depending on the contract, if it costs them more time than that, then they've got to absorb that risk. If it's less, then it swings some roundabouts. But, you know, they've guaranteed that they will deliver that because their business depends on it. Mm. You know, if you don't deliver it to the right quality by next Friday, then you probably won't get the next contract. So what a great incentive that is to deliver.
I wonder.
We've got this presenteeism, really.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, you've got to be in the office, or even we've got to be able to see you. You've got to be committed to this. The company has got to own you. You've got to be dedicated to the company. Well, I don't want to be dedicated to one company. I actually enjoy working with a lot of different companies, and I want them to trust me to deliver the outcomes to the quality that they want. And I'm quite happy for my reputation to stand or fall by whether I do deliver the quality. And I think there's a lot of professionals in my position that kind of share that mentality, if only they were given more opportunity to do that.
I wonder, Dave, whether it's also about control and knowing that where these people are and what they're actually doing. But you should be able to build all of those elements into the outcome, because you could talk about how much time this might take and what the price for that would be. And what would happen if it didn't actually end up with the way that we actually envisaged? What will we do then? It's a similar thing to talking about a project that's running. You know, what do we do with this project that's looking like it's going to be over budget? You know, we can either stop it where we are. We can reduce the scope of work. We can get the team to work harder, which doesn't generally benefit anybody. Or we can extend it and pay the price. I wonder whether people are just of a fixed mindset about how you employ people. And now, like you're saying, I thought that was you've got some great sound bites today. You know, where's the gig economy for people in professional services? What a great question.
But on that, John, I think like what you just said there really taps into something. This thing about control is, it's no surprise whatsoever. Like, I think we've got to be compassionate to people and why they are behaving like this. And my view, only my view, is I don't know why people are surprised at all that the likes of Elon Musk wants everybody back in the office now, because it's the pendulum. When there's so much uncertainty, the pendulum swings are so much bigger. And it's this, you know, there's so much uncertainty. We had all that uncertainty in COVID, and you kind of thought things would get better in 2022. Lo and behold, they get even worse. And you get a war, then you get a war that's worse than the pandemic. Oh my goodness, certainly things can't get any better. Now there's no tomatoes on the supermarket shelves. You know, it's like, there's no food. There's no food. Like, what's worse than war? Everybody's starving, no choice. And I think it doesn't surprise me at all. And it's back to what you said, John. It's about this, as things get more and more uncertain, it takes an incredibly aware, assertive, mindful, positive leader to be able to stay in that space of safer uncertainty. Remember when we had Matt Locke on the podcast? Yeah. And actually it's way easier to just jump back, swing the pendulum the other side and go, it's control. I want to pay you. I want to own you, like what you said, Dave. I want to know where everybody sat there working for me, because it gives them some sense of control. Well, a sense, I say a sense, because you've got no control, because things are so blooming uncertain. And I don't know the answer to that. There's some really heartwarming stuff and some testing stuff, you know, some new stuff coming out, but big personalities love to assert control, and that sways a lot of people, doesn't it? And I don't know. I think what's interesting though, what you said about where's the gig economy for the over 50s? What really does warm my heart is I did read something in the paper this week around, I don't know whether this stat's right, it was in the Evening Standard, that 50% of under 30-year-olds now are participating in, they have some kind of side hustle, even if it is just selling their used, their unwanted stuff on Vinted or eBay, because they can't afford to live anymore on a salary. So workers are going to have to embrace this concept of a side hustle unless they're wanting to give 15, 20, 25% pay rises. And for the first time in a long time, we're going to end up with NHS workers with massive side hustles because they can't afford to live.
Yeah. And what's really great as a byproduct from that, Rachel, I think, is that that side hustle, people will discover things about themselves that they're actually, you know, business people dying to break out. They're really, you know, even just selling stuff on Vinted, you know, it gives them such a buzz that they'll be the company owners of the future doing what I've done in kind of 20 years time. But the really sad thing that's always saddened me is when you walk through that door of that corporate organization that you work for 9 to 5, 5 days a week, people switch off that entrepreneurial spirit, that all that stuff they do in their spare time, whether it's a side hustle or whether it's volunteering or whatever. You know, how can corporations stop them switching that off and actually bring that to bear in their day-to-day job? And I truly believe that one of the reasons they do that is because of the control that companies exert, as you say, Rachel. You know, it's the 9 to 5. It's a, you must be here. You must be at your desk. We'll manage you in a certain way. You switch off all that other stuff and say it's not relevant here. But yet you've got entrepreneurs coming in through your door, going into a meeting to talk about innovation.
I think you're right. And I think what will be interesting, it does feel incredibly frustrating and it is upsetting to read the press at the minute. But fast forward a couple of years, I think this is what keeps me going, is that we'll have the data to match, where you'll have the impacts of the pandemic and more flexible working. Then you'll have the go back to the control. Then you'll have this side hustle stuff. And you may be able to see some patterns of the companies that did the best and that innovate the most are the ones that somehow let go of the control and embrace letting people be truly vulnerable in themselves in the workplace and find a way to work more flexibly. We'll have to wait and see how that pans out.
Yeah, I think it's a great phrase from systems thinking, if you've done that, which is organize yourself around the work. And if you think that through, that's completely the opposite of what we're doing now, which is to say you've got to be in the office 2 or 3 days a week. Because what you're doing is you're setting a parameter and you're trying to squeeze the work into the hierarchy and into being, you know, what makes us think that being in the office 2 or 3 days a week is the best way to do the work? You know, let the teams decide what the work is and how best to do it. And if that means all being in the office one day, then fine. But let that drive it, not some kind of top-down edict that says you've got to be in the office 2 or 3 days a week or 5 days a week because Elon Musk says you've got to be in.
Yeah.
That will hinder the work, not help it.
Dave, lots and lots of food for thought. Thank you so much for being here today. As usual, we always ask our guests to give us 3 leadership essentials. So what are your 3 leadership essentials as we wind this up?
Okay. Very briefly, first one is give it some emotion. You know, leadership is a people business. People need to see that you're human. Don't get stuck in the transactional stuff of leadership. That's my first one. My second one is it's a hark back to the 70s and 80s, but I think it's as true now as it ever was, which is what I would call leadership by walking about. IBM used to call it management by walking about. So change the M to an L. You know, we understand now the difference between leadership and management. Leadership by walking about. Leadership isn't delivered in a boardroom, sat around the to making decisions, looking at reports. It's about working with people. It's about getting out there. That was why I had that urge to get to Bristol to sit. And the CIO of that business, you know, those systems costing 35 million a year. Boy, I used to go out and kind of, you know, walk about and just somebody once gave me some feedback and said, Dave, you know, we don't think you're approachable. And it really hurt me. And I thought, I've always been approachable in my head. But what it was really simple when they explained it to me. So when you go to the printer, you know, you sit there at your emails all day, you got your head down at the desk, you go to the printer and you rush into the printer, you get your print, and then you rush back to your desk to get back on your emails. They said, we don't feel we can interrupt you because you look so busy. So after that, when I used to go to sites, if I used to go to Bristol for the day, I used to clear out my diary. So I had nothing to do. And I used to love just walking about and having a coffee. And people would stop you and they'd tell you stuff that you wouldn't otherwise have found out. It's just walking about. It's amazing. It's amazing. And our parish priest, I once spoke to him, whether you're a parish priest or whether you're a leader in business, he used to set aside a day and he just used to walk around York. And he used to bump into so many parishioners and he used to start a conversation and just chat to him. Leadership by walking about, you can't beat it. So make sure you clear your diary out and do some of that stuff. And then the third thing is something we touched on earlier, which is getting into the work. You know, don't sit in the boardrooms. When you're out, make sure you spend some time with your if you're an IT, say, person as I was, go and see the people that use your systems. Don't rely on the reports. Don't rely on what you're told by people. As a leader, people often think that when they become a leader, there are certain things they can't do anymore. You know, I spoke to somebody recently and said, you know, he was a board director and he said, oh, yeah, we just deal with strategy. We don't deal with operational stuff. You'll have to speak to somebody else about the operational stuff. And I thought, what an opportunity missed. So, yeah, I just used to go and sit on the same bank of desks as people using the system and listen to what they were saying. And then when we got chatting, I'd say, oh, just show me that system. What's wrong with it? And they'd show you. And you go back and you'd have so many gold nuggets. Next time you went to the boardroom, you could speak with confidence and say, well, I went down to Dorking and I sat with the people using this system. So all this list of defects that you're talking about, you're talking about the wrong stuff, because actually what they want is they just want better performance, because I've spoken to them and that's what they said. But so many leaders don't feel they have permission to do that because they're stepping on other people's toes. And you can see how people have done it in the past. I mean, you know, retail leaders, and we probably know who we're talking about, used to go into their stores. And they used to like look what was on the rails and how it was arranged. But then when they found something wrong, they just gave everybody a bollocking. Well, any idiot can do that. It's about if you get into the work and you're walking about, you're meeting your customers, you're meeting your people that use your systems, you know, where's the respect? You know, treat them with respect and leave them feeling good about you being there, so that you're not there to give them a bollocking. You're there to actually help them and to understand the issues that they're dealing with. So that's
absolutely
my third.
Love them. We've never had those three before. I knew that you would come up with something really quite useful. The one about walking about, I think it is really important to differentiate, isn't it? That doesn't mean telling everybody that your door is always open. That's very... And lots of people think that is that piece, but it's not. It's about being present, and I think it's about having the time for people. Really like the idea of just completely clearing your day out. I think sometimes it can be a little bit more challenging now in the workplace because people are quite remote and we have remote teams and what have you, but there is still that ability to be there physically, isn't there?
Yeah. And there's certainly still people using, you know, everybody's got customers, whether you run a guest house, whether you run a multi-million pound business. find out who your customers are and go and sit with them.
Yeah.
And go and, you know, go and sample what they see on a daily basis. Go and stay in your own guest house or, you know, your hotel chain. A lot of people do it. It's kind of back to the work stuff. And it absolutely, I used to avoid the big presidential visits. So Dave's coming on site today. So let's do this and be ready for him. Let's prepare a bullet point PowerPoint presentation for him. No, that's the wrong thing to do. Just give me some space and just, you know, just give me some time just to show me what you do.
Yeah.
And listen, you know, I'll listen to you. You listen to me and we'll have a good conversation. That's all it's about.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that, Dave. If people want to get in touch with you, they can find your link to your LinkedIn profile on our website. But if they also want to find or contact you, where's the best place to go, Dave?
Yeah, just go directly to harper360.com. You'll find a bit more information there about what we've talked about. Or you can email me at info@harper360.com.
Fabulous. And you mentioned that you were part of York Minds. So if anybody is a coach listening to this, they could probably get in touch with them about doing some mentoring like what you do as well, couldn't they?
Yeah, that's right. If anybody wants to speak to me directly about what I do and that and other voluntary positions, then yeah, by all means, just drop me a line and I can share whatever wisdom I've got with you.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for that. Great to chat to you. And say we've known each other for years. I've learned a lot in that conversation. So thank you very much. A lot about you as well.
Yeah.
I didn't know. So yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you've got a lot out of this. If you'd like to read up a bit more on any of the content that you've heard in today's podcast, be sure to check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com.